He briefed President Obama and the National Security Council. The intelligence mosaic began to emerge. DOD loaned SEALs to the CIA. President Obama, whose faith in the CIA had grown during the last 2 years, approved the attack. Under the CIA's Title 50 authorities, the SEALs had served as the covert action strike force of the CIA. It was a beautiful blend of intelligence and lethal statecraft, a harmony of sensors and shooters, in one of America's greatest, most righteous covert actions. The nullification of AQ leadership is a strategic objective. This brilliant and bold raid was the most important step in reaching that goal. For the many AQ victims and their families around the world, those of all faiths, this was also a moment of justice. Denial of enemy safe haven is another objective. Our efforts in Afghanistan during 2001-2002 severely disrupted and diminished AQ's capabilities, but the U.S. government and the international community failed to capitalize on that initial success. As the ambassador at large and coordinator for counterterrorism from 2005 to 2007, I witnessed this failure. I also watched AQ expand and flourish inside Pakistan. This is where the Taliban had regrouped. With a network of radical allies throughout Pakistan, their ideological cancer spread. During a visit to Pakistan in 2006, I spoke with Minister of the Interior, Aftab Ahmed Sherpao, who expressed his fears of a Talibanized Pakistan. A Pashtun from Peshawar, he understood the threat. He would survive multiple assassination attempts in his valiant but unsuccessful efforts to reverse this dangerous trend. Many other brave Pakistanis, such as the newly elected Prime Minister Benazir Bhutto, would die at the hands of AQ, the Taliban, and their allies. Other Pakistani officials in the military and the intelligence services protected and encouraged these militant groups as proxy forces against India, Afghanistan, and the United States. From their bases in Pakistan, the Taliban slipped back into Afghanistan and regenerated their support networks. By 2006, the Taliban controlled swaths of territory in the east and the south of Afghanistan. The United States surged more troops, and by 2011, with more than 100,000 U.S. servicemen deployed, blunted the Taliban's spread. Could the United States hand off the security responsibility to the Afghans? When? In 2009, President Obama directed an increase in armed drone attacks in Pakistan's tribal areas. These drones killed hundreds of AQ and Taliban operatives. AQ members dispersed into smaller groups, and many fled Pakistan for safer areas, including Yemen and Somalia. The Taliban and other terrorist groups in Pakistan remained a persistent threat. Like AQ, they developed an agenda beyond the Afghanistan-Pakistan theater. The horrible attack on Mumbai, India in 2008 underscored this. Some Pakistan Taliban advocated and plotted attacks in the U.S. homeland, such as the failed New York Times Square bombing in 2010. AQ affiliates in Somalia, Yemen, and Northern Africa continued to operate there and beyond. In 2010, Al-Shabaab operatives from Somalia launched an attack in Kampala, Uganda, that killed 74. AQ in Yemen, using the name Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, attempted to destroy U.S.-bound aircraft, in one case with explosives hidden in printer cartridges. In our flat, integrated global battlefield, sophisticated and determined enemies, especially with territory under their control, can pose a threat almost anywhere. The mitigation of conditions that give rise to Al-Qaeda and their allies is another strategic objective. In Afghanistan, U.S. and allied forces have been mixed. Health care and education improved dramatically. In 2001, fewer than 10% of Afghans had access to basic health care. A decade later, almost two-thirds do. Under the harsh Taliban rule, few boys and no girls attended school. By 2011, more than 7 million children, including 2.5 million girls, were in class. Afghanistan's governance and economic development were languishing, however. The $15 billion in U.S. non-military aid over the last decade failed to help the Afghans establish the rule of law and free markets. The World Bank estimated that 97% of Afghanistan's legitimate gross domestic product, GDP, was derived from foreign aid, and most of that was lost to inefficiencies and corruption. Perhaps as much as half the actual GDP came from illegal drug commerce. The overwhelming majority of Afghans did not want the Taliban back, but they did want security and rule of law. The Afghan people did not want AQ in their country. Neither did some of the Afghan Taliban, many fighting the United States simply because we were there. Many Afghan Taliban fighters had no desire or even concept of a war beyond their borders. Other radical groups around the world learned hard lessons about their affiliation with AQ. Varying degrees of counterterrorism success in Southeast Asia and Iraq, as examples, cast doubt on the strategic and operational competence of AQ and their severely depleted leadership. AQ and other transnational threats underscored the common interests of nations and peoples. Nations and various institutions were more aware of the terrorist threat, and cooperation continued to grow. This was one of my primary missions while serving as the U.S. coordinator for counterterrorism, to advance that awareness and cooperation. The greatest blow to AQ came not with a kinetic strike or a policy initiative, but rather from Muslim masses launching the 2011 Arab Spring protests. Repressive governments fell in Tunisia, Egypt, and Libya. The people in Yemen, Syria, and elsewhere took to the streets. This had nothing to do with AQ and their allies. This revolution was populist, sparked by a search for justice and dignity, and spread through global telecommunication and social networks. The people were attacking the conditions that AQ sought to exploit. Would these conditions be mitigated to the point where AQ's hateful ideology lost purchase? Would these idealistic citizen rebels be able to build liberal institutions, or would others, such as the Muslim Brotherhood, hijack the revolutions? Would AQ gain greater room for maneuvering in the ungoverned space of Yemen and elsewhere? Would there be another attack on the U.S. homeland, where homegrown, self-radicalized terrorists were increasingly common? The Arab Spring erupted in the global context of economic crisis in the West, particularly Southern Europe, and economic boom in China and India. Other emerging powers, such as Brazil and Indonesia, offered exceptional opportunities for global economic growth and political stability rooted in networked liberal institutions. There were more liberal institutions and democracies in the world than ever before. There were also more and varied risks. Driven by disruptive technologies, the pace of change continued to accelerate. New non-state actors, both good and bad, challenged the status quo. Whether a single humiliated Tunisian street vendor who immolated himself and ignited the Arab Spring, or a single anarchist group like WikiLeaks, which undermined U.S. diplomatic relations, they represented a new kind of global asymmetric power. After the first decade of the 21st century, the world is much more challenging. Government and private sector leaders face expanding, complex sets of risk and opportunity. What group will be the next AQ? When will the U.S. homeland be attacked, and how will we respond? Will Iran develop nuclear weapons and provide them to their proxies like Hezbollah? Will Iraq forge a viable democratic government that responds to its citizens' needs? Will Mexico continue to grow into a dynamic, liberal, free market society, or be undermined by narco-criminals challenging the sovereignty of the state? Will cyberspace ever be secure? As a global stakeholder, will China become more responsible or less? Will Russia defeat corruption and establish itself as an enduring economic power? How will barn technologies affect our commercial, economic, and geopolitical world? Which inventors and entrepreneurs will develop transformative technologies that provide us resilient, reliable, renewable energy? How will the United States address the two most important of all national security concerns, the economy and the education of our citizens? Randomness and uncertainty, often acute in times of rapid change, can breed anxiety and fear. But change plays to America's strengths. Our Constitution and our liberal institutions are designed for adaptability. With strong, adaptable, and resilient citizens who demand leaders worthy of the name, the best years may still be ahead of us. We need leaders who embrace intellectual integrity, constructive political discourse, and hard-nosed governance